Kate Gamal, interviewed by Jared Spool. Recorded at the studios of User Interface Engineering, March 28th, 2007. Back in March, we hosted our friend and colleague Kate Gamal for a virtual seminar on field studies. We then recorded a follow-up podcast for attendees with their questions from the seminar. We thought it was so useful on its own that today we'd like to offer it to all of our Spoolcast listeners. Field testing is so important to great design that we've dedicated our latest 117-page report to the topic. Kate Gamal, along with Ellen Story Church and Eric Bond, have assembled their collective knowledge into a comprehensive guide to the field study process, from planning to observing to analysis. If you're interested in the report, we'll have a special discount code for Spoolcast listeners at the end of this episode. And now, here are Kate and Jared.
Hello, welcome everybody to the follow-up podcast to the virtual seminar on field studies. I have on the phone here Kate Gamal from Gamal Research. Hi, Kate.
Hi, Jared.
Hi. For those of you who were able to attend our virtual seminar on March 20th, a lot of you asked some really great questions, and so we've taken the opportunity here to schedule a little bit of time to answer some of the ones we couldn't get to during the session. So I'm just going to jump right in here. Jorge had asked, in the process of redesigning a website, when should we start doing field studies? Should we do them at the first draft or of the redesign, or is it something we do a little later?
Well, ideally, you really want to start before the first drafts of the redesign, if possible. We found that with redesigns in particular, doing a combination field study usability test is a great idea and tends to work pretty well, especially if you haven't done usability testing of a recent version of the website. So we try to combine the two. But you should know that it's really never too late to do field research, because you can always roll the results into a later version, or, you know, even if you're halfway into the process, it's not too late. So don't think that if you haven't started yet and you're into the process that you've missed the boat.
Is there any sort of information that you get from a field study that you should potentially wait on before acting on? You know, have you ever run into a situation where it's like, well, if we'd done this earlier, you know, we could have acted on it, but we should probably wait at this point?
Sure. Yeah, I think sometimes you do find that, especially if the implications are really big. They're going to require a major rework and you don't have that much time in your development process and you just need to get the product out the door. So you might find that the results from your field research are suggesting something really different, and you might need to schedule more follow-up research to confirm that, and also possibly a longer development process to make such a big change, for example.
Okay. Kirk wanted to know if, in general, is the idea that you want to have more studies, you know, the more studies the better, or is there a point where you've just saturated and you're just doing too much?
Well, I think that really the best approach is to have an ongoing field study program, if possible, where you're just doing field studies all the time and continually feeding the results back into your product. I mean, that's the ideal situation. But if you're just doing a single study and you kind of want to set it up so that it's a fairly large-scale study, because you think you're going to need to do lots of visits, I would suggest that you do a kind of a phased approach where you do the minimal first, and then have an analysis period, and you can look and see, am I seeing enough patterns in my results that I feel comfortable with this and I don't need the second phase? Then you can say, okay, well, we're not going to go on to phase two. But it's better to err on the side of budgeting and scheduling for the full study, and then with the option of stopping if you're starting to see enough patterns in your results and you have enough confidence that you feel like you know what to do with the product as a result.
Okay. Someone once told me that the point you know when to stop is when you hit the point of least astonishment.
That's true. Yeah, that too. You're starting to see so much repetition. It's like, okay, we've seen this a million times. We know what to do now.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. At that point when you're no longer surprised by anything you see. I got to tell you, in all the studies I've ever done, I've never reached that point.
Yeah, it's pretty hard to reach that point.
But we can. Maybe someday I'll go out there and everything I see I'll have seen at some point before.
Yeah.
Of course, just having seen it before doesn't mean I'll have remembered it and integrated what I had seen.
Exactly.
So I guess we have to go beyond the point of least astonishment. John wanted to know if there were any good tips for note-taking, which I think is a great question. I mean, that's one of the things I struggle with is I sit there with my little notepad and I don't bring a computer because you're not always have the advantage of being able to sit down comfortably or
that's true
or that stuff. So I have a little notepad, but it feels clumsy to me.
Yeah, we found that if we can make up a script for ourselves of the questions that we want to ask, we probably won't ask them in the order that we have in our script, but if we make the script up and we put lots of white space between the questions so we have lots of room to write, and then we leave the backs of the pages blank, that really helps, and we staple it all together so you can easily shuffle among the pages, and then you have lots of scribble room. We found that works really well. Another thing that we've been doing on recent visits is a colleague of mine has been audio recording the visits, and then he started out trying to transcribe them himself, but then he got wise and decided to send them off to a transcriber to transcribe the whole interview or observation, at least what was said. And that we found that's been extremely helpful to fill in the gaps, the things that you weren't able to get down in your own personal notes, and to really make sure that you're covering everything.
The transcription is a great idea, and we use a service that's really inexpensive called castingwords.com.
Oh.
CastingWords.com. We use that for transcribing our podcasts and other things, and it's very cool. It uses the Amazon Mechanical Turk, which means they break it up into little pieces, and they have people all over the world transcribing little bits, and they do it really fast, and it's very inexpensive. A half an hour is usually under $20.
Oh, that's great to know. I will tell my client.
Yeah.
Thank you.
When you have your little packet of paper, what do you use for a writing surface? I always feel intimidated bringing a clipboard.
Oh, yeah. You know, I don't usually bring a clipboard. That's a good question. I guess I usually bring like a fairly solid file folder, and usually I have so many materials. I have like interviews put in there for all the other participants if I'm seeing more than one on a day, so that makes it pretty solid. So it's just a regular old file folder. It's not very intimidating looking.
No, that's a great idea. What about for your notations? Do you have a way of noting certain things? Do you have like a little set of code words or what do you focus on when you're taking notes? Do you have any tricks for that?
Well, I don't have, I don't have any necessarily great, I don't do shorthand or anything. I don't have any really great tips, except that I do a lot of, I'd say, circling of things. I try to, make key points. I write in phrases rather than full sentences. Another technique that I learned from a colleague of mine, Barry Glassford, that I'll sometimes use is to take a blank page and just draw a line down the center, and on the left hand of the page, write down things that I'm observing or hearing directly from the participant, and then on the right side go my interpretations or my personal comments on those things. So it's a nice way to separate your observations and the hard data from your own interpretations.
That's really good, because that's one of the things we talk about a lot is separating out your observations from your inferences.
Yeah.
And making sure you're not inferring things. And if you're doing, like, we have a study coming up where we're visiting 16 sites in like 3 weeks, and I know at the end of those sites I'm going to look back at my notes, and I'm not going to remember which things were hard observations and which things were inferences.
Yeah, so just finding some way to separate those is a really great.
That's really quite clever. Cool, thanks, Barry.
Yeah.
I'm going to get this name wrong, but I'm going to guess it's pronounced Sudhakar. He and I'm going to guess it's a he. This is one of the problems of my cultural ignorance. You know, if it's not in Boston, it doesn't exist as far as I'm concerned. but Sudhakar, our friend Sudhakar, who I'm hopefully will apologize for any mangling I've done of either his name or gender, wanted to know what tools or software you use for analyzing the data, or you know, he also was interested in videos.
Sure, we don't really use any very fancy tools. I mean, we make great use of Excel. We tend to come up with what we call tick sheets. It's really just taking the participants and putting them along one axis and taking the whatever you're trying to track, be it a problem, an observation, a user need, those kinds of things go down the other axis, and then we just start marking, you know, who had that need, who exhibited that problem, who had that frustration, for example. And then you start to, that quickly shows you where the patterns are starting to develop. So we use those tick sheets in lots of ways. Let's see, what else do we do? When we're analyzing video, of course, you know, we'll use video editing software if we're trying to pull out key clips. And then we make great use of highlighter pens and Post-its when we're looking at the physical data. If we'll do affinity diagramming, for example, which is basically just taking, you know, key observations and doing groupings, we'll use Post-it notes for that. Online, we use the change tracking tools in Word, for example, to do highlighting for other people to make notes. To just pretty much make the patterns visible is really what we're trying to do.
Cool. I mean, yeah, it's hard to know what we get this analyzing. You know, what do you use to analyze your data? Question a lot, and it's really hard to know what to do to analyze the data until you have the data at hand.
Because exactly.
In my experience, the data sort of dictates how you analyze it. And, you know, clients, it's one of the hardest things to do is to budget time for analyzing stuff at the beginning of the project because you don't know what that's going to require.
Right. And one of the tricks we've used is to try to think up front, even when we're designing the study and figuring out what materials to produce, what are the deliverables we hope will come out of the study? So, for example, if you know that you're going to try to develop personas, then there's certain kinds of things you're going to want to, data you're going to want to collect about the users. Maybe you're looking for certain kinds of behavior that you're going to want to track. And so that kind of helps you figure out, well, what am I looking for so that I can produce the persona? If you wanted to produce a list of user needs, for example, you're going to be wanting to track user needs. And so you'll want to find ways that you can highlight user needs in your results and come up with these lists. So think about the deliverables and what it is that's going to come out of the results, and that helps you figure out how you should analyze it and what things you should be highlighting.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's you know, it's interesting because I'll actually start making notes as I'm collecting the data. It says, oh, we should look at this or we should look at this other thing. So my analyzing plan sort of evolves while I'm sitting with the participants.
Yeah, me too. And sometimes you find out that's also a good point, that with field research, you can modify your data collection tools as you go, because that does happen. You'll be on site with a participant and you realize, oh, I just thought of a great question I'm going to ask or an observation I want to make. I want to make sure I do that with everybody else. And so then you might change your materials when you get back to make sure you ask that question or make that observation, which means that sometimes you'll also need to then call back the people that you observed earlier and ask them those questions, or you might need to do some follow-up observations. But that's a good point, Jared. That happens all the time.
Right. Yeah, I mean, one of the things we do, I don't know if you do this, is we actually schedule that time into the project.
Yes.
We put 2 hours between every 2 to 4 visits to go back and revisit our questions and materials and update them and see if we want to change the direction of the study or any of those things. And so, for instance, when we're doing the 16-participant study coming up, we're going to have 4 of those sessions with the team to review what we've seen so far and figure out what we want to do going forward.
Yes, that's a really good practice. I highly recommend it. And that helps you also with what we were talking about earlier, a phased approach where you can say, okay, well, what are we seeing? You know, how close are we to feeling like we have enough? And how much more do we need to do?
Cool. Cool. Carlos had an interesting question about, his specific question was for web redesign, do you use additional tools to support your observation, in a given period of time, like, Google Analytics or tracking or log analyzers? But I guess the bigger question is, do you treat field studies in isolation, or do you think of them, as a piece of a larger integrated research plan? And how are some of the ways you've packaged those together?
I definitely think field research is part of a larger plan, and all those things supplement each other. My point with field research is just make sure that you don't use those tools like the analytics and the logging and the tracking in isolation without ever seeing anybody in context. I think they all fit together, and planning for them to fit together and be integrated is going to give you the best truest picture of how people are using your product or website.
Right. I'm wondering, though, when you're talking to your clients or you're putting together your projects, are you definitively in a field studies phase, and then that's all you're thinking about during that piece, and then you move on to something else,
or no?
Do your projects, always have this sort of very integrated discussion going on?
Well, we try to make sure that we have an integrated discussion going on. Certainly, I think that's the best approach. And if you can, find out and know what other activities are happening at the same time or could be happening in parallel, just to fill out this picture, bigger picture, that's the best approach. And so we do try to find out, okay, have you done any usability testing? Are you collecting these logs? Are you doing the analytics? And how can we all communicate and work together as we develop this bigger picture?
Right. We had a project recently where it wasn't a field studies project. We were doing usability testing.
Mm-hmm.
We noticed in the usability test that every time people went to sign in into the system, they would forget what password and, more importantly, in many cases, what email address they had used to create their username under, because, people change their email addresses and sometimes they don't use the system for several years.
Right.
And what was interesting was we saw a whole bunch of people in our study going to the Forgot Your Password page. And so that made us ask the question, I wonder how many people do that. So we went back and looked at the logs for the previous couple days on the site and found out that a third of all people who went to log in went to the Forget Your Password.
Wow.
And then we further on saw that, many of them requested the email to log in. And then it took us a little longer to figure this out, but we found out that only about 10% of those inevitably logged in from that email. And we were realizing that login process was causing people to leave. And we wouldn't have known to look for that until we saw it in the study.
Yes, and that's great. So the study helped you figure out how to look at the data in logs and how to make use of that. So then that log data became really great backup for your findings in the field research.
It really did, and we learned that people were really put off by having to log into this particular site because much of the information they were looking for wasn't any need to be protected. it was information that had they called the 800 number and not given any personal information, the person would have gladly told them.
Right. Very good example. Yeah, I think you need to look at it as these are all pieces of the bigger puzzle, and the more pieces we can work with together, the better our picture of the big puzzle is going to be.
That's right. So Christina asked if you had any tips about how to put participants at ease when they're being videotaped or photographed. My guess is putting a parrot on their shoulder and making them wear an eye patch is not the way.
No, not the best idea. I guess the best thing to do is we always try to discuss it ahead of time, and we explain why we need to take video, how we're going to use the video or photographs, and then the kinds of things that we're trying to capture. I mean, letting them know that that their face is not really, you know, the focus. That usually when we're taking video, we're really looking at the screen, we're looking at their environment, you know, and getting their face in there is really incidental, so that, you know, they know that that's not the primary reason. And we're not taking video to, you know, put up and show millions of people, that it's for research purposes to help us find patterns in the data. So really trying to help them understand why we're taking the video or the photographs. And then when you get out into the field and you're actually doing this, you know, setting up the video, we found that having a helper along is a great idea. If you have somebody who can unobtrusively set up the video in the background while the interviewer talks to the person and kind of gets them relaxed before you start videotaping, that helps. And if you can set the video up so that it's kind of like over their shoulder, not directly in their face. Sometimes that's not possible if it's a webcam, but webcams tend to be a little less obtrusive anyway, because they're so small.
Right.
And then for photographs, we try to ease them into the photographs as well. We don't come in snapping pictures immediately. And we ask permission before we take a picture. So, you know, we start off with more environmental pictures, like, oh, could I take a picture of your work area? Or how about this piece of paper? Is it okay to take a picture of this? And then we'll show them the photographs, like on a digital camera, so that they can say, oh, yeah, that's fine. You can have that. And then we save the you know, sometimes we do want to have a face shot of the person, but we'll save that until later after they've gotten used to us, they understand what we're doing, they're more comfortable, and a lot of times we'll take that face shot at the very end.
Do you do things like try to avoid using the flash?
Yes. Yeah, that's a really good idea. And especially you want to avoid it if you're taking pictures of the screen.
Right.
It doesn't work with a flash anyway, but that's a great idea. Try not to use the flash if, you know, you're in an environment where it'll work.
Do you try to use a tripod, or do you try to avoid a tripod, or?
We do use a tripod usually if we can, if it works in the environment. So some environments where you're getting up and walking around a lot, it's not going to work. But in a cubicle, if you can get enough distance, a tripod is nice because you can set it up and sort of leave it alone, and then the participants kind of forgets about it. Especially if you can set it back a little ways.
That's true. We actually found one of these little 1 foot tall tripods. They're not even 1 foot. They're like,
oh yeah, I've used those before too.
Yeah, yeah.
And you can put them on a desktop.
Put them on a desktop, and the one we have has like a Velcro strap, so you can like Velcro it to the side of a cube.
That's really nice.
It's very cool.
Because yeah, the full size tripods do get in the way of a cubicle.
They do. They do, and they're onerous, and they're clumsy, and I think they're a little off-putting.
They are.
I think they are.
But you also don't want to just have a camera in your hand and be kind of zooming and panning and, you know, make the person feel like they're on a TV show. So you don't want to get in their face with it.
Right, right. The camera we've been using is actually a picture camera. It's the Canon SureShot. The one I have is an SD630. It's a beautiful little camera. It's got a really big screen, but it has a movie mode that actually takes really good movies.
Oh, that's good. And you can get a long enough time so that you can keep it running, or?
Well, I don't typically run it for the whole interview. I typically sort of switch between camera photos and video.
That's good.
In our stuff. And so I just sort of video particular things when I think a sequence is going to be interesting. Of course, every so often you go, "Oh, I wish I'd video that." But,
right. Yeah, that's the catch. Trying to make, you know, yeah, find those things that you really are going to want. You know, but then sometimes you have somebody kind of replay it if you.
That's right.
Can you do that again? So
that's
I
right.
can get it on tape. But yeah, that's a good point. If you can get your equipment to be as small as possible, that's really helpful. It's a lot less intimidating.
Well, the beauty of this thing is it fits in your pocket, and it. It makes very good videos. The audio is really good. It's very unassuming, and the user doesn't really know the participant doesn't know when you're switching between video and camera, so it's not really in your face.
Right, and if you've already gotten permission for that, then you don't have to announce it every time.
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, we can still show them at the end and say, hey, can we keep this, or, you know,
right,
can we delete it? We can delete it right in front of them. And we use a 2 gigabyte card, which will hold, you know, quite a bit of stuff.
That's great.
Yeah, so it works out really well. Now, I have another question related to this, because you mentioned bringing along a person. I often bring along members of the team.
Yes.
Who, for in most cases, these are their first field study things. And I often use, giving them tasks, like giving one person the camera and telling them what I want them to capture, as a way to give them something to do.
Right.
Because I have found that particularly for people on their first visits, they're not sure what they're supposed to be doing there.
Right, so they're uncomfortable. So, yeah, you're right. I do that, too. Give them a task that's useful to you, taking video, taking photographs, observing particular things and making observations. It keeps them busy, makes them comfortable, gives them something to do, and also keeps them from interfering with the progress of the study, too, which can
be
important.
Right. That's right. Yeah. And there's nothing worse than being in a situation and not knowing what you're supposed to be doing there and just feeling like a third wheel.
Right. And one, even if your equipment is very small, there usually is enough to carry and enough to do because you want to capture as much as you possibly can in this short period of time, that it is helpful to have another person there.
Let's see here. What do we have? Adam wanted to know when you're conducting. You had mentioned during the seminar that sometimes in a field, when you're out in the field, you'll conduct a field-based usability test. So you'll sort of switch out of the mode where you're observing whatever it is that they want to show you. To some extent, that's not quite right, but whatever it is that you want to see them show you, but it's not so much a usability test, but more of an interview or observation of their regular work. But then maybe you'll bring up a prototype, or you'll have them use a particular system that you're interested in, and what's the logistics of that? Do you make like an explicit change in how you're doing things? Do you like then sit next to them like you would if you were facilitating a usability test, or is there like an explicit thing that you do to sort of say, okay, now we're going to do something different here, or do you just let it flow?
Well, that's a good question. I do pretty much let it flow, but I try to do the true field research activities where you're really watching what they naturally do those things earlier on. Before I do the more guided, now I want to see how you do this particular task because we're trying to get everybody to do this task. So that's I save that till later in the study because having them do specific tasks might influence their behavior. So we do try to make some sort of a break, but it doesn't have to seem like an explicit break to the participant. And we really just sit wherever is most comfortable. We don't go away and try to make it seem like a lab setting where we leave, go into another cube and have them start to do their work. We're always close by. So, the first part might be more like typical shadowing, and sometimes it's an active sort of visit where you're physically following them around, and then you might, for the second part, have them sit down and actually, sit next to them and have them go through some specific tasks.
Okay. Are these tasks you've often prepared in advance, or do you find that you'll be sitting there and you'll see them do something and you'll say, gee, I wonder how they'll be able to do this task, and you'll just sort of create a usability test spontaneously?
Yeah. Well, that's part of, having them do tasks that they naturally do, or if they've done the task rankings and they've said, these are my most frequent and important tasks, I consider that a normal part of the field study process to say, okay, well, you said this is, this one's really frequent or this one's really important. Can you show me how you do that? And that's, just part of the field study process. But oftentimes I do have a set of tasks that's more similar to a usability test where I have, three or four things that I want to make sure I get everybody to do, even if it's not something that they do frequently or have said is important, because I just want to, see how they would approach that task. That's more like a typical usability test. So it does kind of flow together, but I'd say that especially with website redesigns, I found that I do want to have at least a few tasks that I ask everybody to do. And then the rest are more freeform and depend on what the participant would do naturally or has told me is most frequent or important.
These tasks, are they with sort of made up context like we would do in the lab, or are you using elements of their actual work?
I use elements of their actual work. So you'll get those early questions out first about, what are their typical activities and how do they work and what are their goals, and then you try to weave their true goals into the the usability tasks.
If they don't have any particular work, you know, let's say the task you're interested in is entering a new customer into the system, but they don't have a new customer to enter into the system. Do you have them sort of fake it, or do you have them, for instance, re-enter the last customer that they had to enter?
You can go either way. Yeah, I mean, I think you'd ideally want to do the most natural thing, you know, make it real if you can. But then if there just isn't a real situation, you should have some prepared. So you could run it more like a typical usability test where you give them the data and have them do it.
Okay. Stan asked about, you had talked about in the session, tag team interviewing.
Yes.
And that was something he was unfamiliar with. And frankly, I'm not 100% sure what you were referring to. Can you talk about that in more detail and how that works?
Sure. This works best if you have a colleague who has done quite a bit of this kind of work, is skilled in interviewing and observing, and you feel comfortable if you're lucky enough to have a fellow researcher to go out with. What we do is we split it up. So basically, one researcher will ask a question and be listening to the response and making observations based on that question, while the second researcher is also listening to the response and thinking about, okay, based on this response or this observation, I'm going to look through the interview script and my opportunities for observation and think about what would be the most logical next question to ask. Because oftentimes your interview script, you know, you try to set it up in a logical way, but it might not flow as well as it could. And so you want to be able to skip around. Having that second researcher there to be able to pick out the next best question and then ask it, then it gives time for the first researcher to go again, look through, now listening to this response or this watching this observation, what would be the next logical thing to do. It just helps make the interview and the observation flow more naturally so it doesn't feel canned and it doesn't feel like an interrogation. And then you also, you know, you get...
So you're not doing good cop, bad cop then?
No. No, it's really more to help it flow better. And, you know, you still get all the questions asked and all the observations made, but it's just going in a more natural order.
Oh, okay. See, that wasn't what I imagined at all. I imagined something that involved, you know, masks and coming in from the ropes. And...
It's not that fancy.
Okay. I'm thinking of some other tag team thing, I guess. Cindy had a great question. She wanted basically to know about how you bring back what you learned to not just the team members, but also to the various stakeholders. So in such a way that you can show the value of what you're learning. There's some stuff you're bringing back because you actually need to make changes or you're going to try and get that information integrated in the design. But do you do something special in the process to show the executive team and others, you know, why this was so valuable and why you need to do more of this?
Yeah, we're actually thinking about that all the time. I mean, from the very first visit that we go on, when we write up those incremental reports and start sending those around, we're immediately trying to make sure that we keep the key stakeholders involved and understanding that we are making progress. And then if you have the luxury of being able to reserve a conference room, for example, or have a space that's your own, or maybe it's even just your own cube walls, we start to post things from our field research just as kind of reminders to ourselves, but also teasers so that when people come by our area or our offices and they see these things, they start to ask questions. And then we use that as an opportunity to give an impromptu little presentation about the results and how they're coming along. And then we'll also schedule time as we're really starting to pull the results together and we're beginning to analyze it, we'll schedule time with people to come and help us with that analysis process. So for example, you can set up exercises where maybe you've collected a whole bunch of user needs, and you want to have people help you prioritize those user needs. And you could invite users back in to help you prioritize, but then you could also have a session with key stakeholders to help you start brainstorming. Once you've prioritized those needs and you said, okay, these are the key needs we want to work towards solving, let's have some brainstorming sessions about how we could approach solving those needs or meeting those needs. And then we talked quite a bit about this in the presentation, but having deliverables that can be used in lots of ways, having all those one-pagers that you can use, you know, for like a two-minute presentation of saying, you know, oh, these are the top 10 most important and frequent tasks. Just take a look at these. Let's post them around us and make sure that we use this list as best we can to spend our design time and do our usability testing, that sort of thing. I also recommend that you take all of your results, so all your one-pagers, all your reports, your analysis, as you develop it and put it someplace central, give access to people to get to that. So on your company intranet, or maybe you have a shared server, organize it and put it out there, and always, you know, give links to that in your presentations and send email and let people know that they can go there anytime and take a look at how the research is shaking out and what recommendations are you starting to make. Another thing you can do is start a discussion group on that site or on that intranet area, or a blog, so that people can start reacting to the data that you're coming back with. And that opens up the community even larger to take and use the data. So we found that's kind of a fun way to keep people involved.
Yeah, we're actually, for this project that we're doing, we're putting together a wiki.
Oh, great, yeah.
And so we're gonna put the interim reports that, you know, come out of each visit, the sort of first instant reports, we're gonna put those as we go. And we're going to use the wiki for various, you know, project ideas and discussions. And you know, the neat thing about wikis is you can sort of link back and forth. So you can, if you have a particular theme that emerges, you can from the individual pages, you can link to that theme page that discusses the theme you're seeing, and then you can link back to the individual observations. And
oh, that's great. And that gets people who aren't even, you know, centralized, who maybe couldn't get together in a regular meeting, to be able to be involved.
Yeah, well, this particular project, we've got basically three different organizations. We've got us and our client, and then our clients hired, we convinced them, they were actually going to wait, we convinced them to hire the design team before we started the studies.
That's
so
good.
That they could come on the studies with us. But they're a completely different organization. So we've got three different organizations that we're trying to communicate between. So we're using these tools to do that.
And that helps people feel ownership over the data, too, if they can, you know, have a part in commenting on it and coming up with, you know, ideas and brainstorming with it.
You mentioned securing wall space, you know, like in a conference room.
Yeah.
One of our clients did something absolutely brilliant. They secured the wall space outside the women's and men's restrooms.
Oh, we did that. I did that too. Yeah, it's perfect. I did that when I was working at GE. It was this big blank wall. And
no one ever decorates people decorate the stalls of the restrooms, but that's not what we were thinking.
I know. It's a great idea. And, you know, if there is well
a lot of good traffic.
Yeah, everybody comes by. And if you can, you know, if you're out there, you know, putting stuff on the walls, people start asking questions, and it's a great opportunity. We did that at the first building I was in at GE. We put it on the walls, and we had these big storyboards, before and after storyboards on the walls. And then we moved, and we went down a floor, and we took the stuff off the walls and put it down, you know, the next floor, because we wanted it to be close to us. And we got all these complaints from the people on the floor above. Why did you take that away? We were using that. So they actually started having meetings of their own around it, you know, annotating and discussing what we'd put up on the wall.
That's excellent. That's excellent. Okay, time for one more question here. Nicole had a great question, which is, she says, in our studies of people in their work environment, we ran into issues with management approval during work hours. Have you dealt with approvals in corporate environments?
Yes, we have. And in corporate environments especially, you do need to make sure that you come in at the right level. Make sure you set the visits up with management. A good way to make sure that you get to see the people that you really want to see is to talk to those higher-level managers initially and flatter them in the sense that, yes, you do want to get information from them. And so set up an interview with those managers or supervisors to ask them those questions about goals and, you know, how they measure success and what they hope to get out of the product and those sorts of things. And then have them find the participants for you, and really, really stress how important it is for you to see the end users and get a chance to visit with the people actually doing the work. Explain to them clearly that, you know, what they can tell you is different from actually seeing people doing the day-to-day work, because you need to be able to see those workarounds. You need to see how people deal with exceptions and what happens when they get interrupted, for example. You really want to see what they have around them. And so taking the time with the management to explain why you're there and why it's valuable and why it's important for them to allow you to do this, definitely important. Now, sometimes the situation is you're going in and you're observing people in a work environment, but you might not be interested in the manager's responses, that you're only interested in end users. And there have been cases where the work happens in the work environment, but it's not officially related to that business. And so then we found we need to come maybe at the end of the day, at, you know, post-work hours, and we'll set that up so that we don't interrupt the day-to-day business. And, you know, you really need to look at the political situation, what's the result of your coming in, and just make sure you thoroughly get approval from the management.
I think that's really good. Have you run into the issue? We've run into this several times where they so want to impress you that they actually set up demos and
yes.
they don't do their real work. They do this sort of fake imaginary work, which isn't what we want at all.
Yeah, I have had that situation, you know, and a big red flag is if they want to take you into a conference room rather than let you watch them at their desk, then, you know, you need to explain.
I have worked at companies where everything happened in the conference room, because no one ever had time to work. They were
on
meetings. but no, you're right. Yeah, the conference room thing is you know, we have to stress, you know, we don't want you to do anything special. We had a site visit a long time ago where we successfully stressed that we don't want anybody to do anything special. We want to see what you normally do. And it was a large corporation, and we came with we came on site with a team of like six people, and we split into groups of two, and each team of two went off to see a different person work.
Yes.
And one of the teams ended up going into this guy. They were assigned to this person, and he said, you really want to watch me do what I normally do? And I said, yeah. So the guy reached in his desk and pulled out his paper and just started to read it.
And that's what I do.
that's what he's been doing. And it turns out that they were using he was a developer, and he was using a version of Lotus Notes, and it was at a bank. And the bank was heavy into compliance, and not only compliance from government regulations, but from every license agreement they'd had. And the bank had literally read the Lotus Notes developer's license, where it said that you can only use one copy at a time, and some other group was using it that day. So he didn't have anything to do, so he
had to
wait until they were done.
Oh, how funny.
And because that's what the rules said. And the funny thing is, we ended up talking to the folks at Lotus, and they said, oh, you know, the end user license is how we make the money. We actually give the developers licenses away, and we don't care if they use more than one. But it turned out they did a little research and found out that the lawyer had accidentally copied that clause from the end user license into the developer's license.
Oh,
and
my gosh.
No one had really looked at it, because nobody thought anybody read those things. But the bank did, because they were in hyper-compliance mode. And
so isn't it great that you asked him to really do what he normally does? Or you would never have come up with
found
that. Never.
Problem with the licenses. And in fact, what we subsequently found was that other people felt guilty that they were sharing these tools that Lotus, in fact, wanted everybody to share, because the more developers were working on this, the more apps were built, the more apps that were built, the more end-user licenses they'd sell.
Wow. Great example. So, yes, I mean, you do want to observe what people really do and take the time to ask those questions. And then you do have, you know, you have other things that you can have them do if you're stuck and you just have all this blank time. You had probably other questions prepared or other things that you could ask him to do, so you didn't have to.
There were, but it was just, you know, one of the observers took it very seriously and started asking him what stories in the paper.
And did any of them have anything to do with his work? Right?
No, it didn't. And we quickly realized this was not an area we wanted to explore further.
Oh, interesting.
But I remember distinctly one of the developers saying, so are you looking for, it was reading the Boston Globe, are you looking for technical information? No, I'm looking for the Celtic scores.
Oh, that's great.
So, okay, well, that pretty much answers all the questions we had. This has been really, really quite fun.
Great, I've enjoyed it. Thank you.
Excellent. Well, if you happen to miss the original virtual seminar, it's available on the UIE site, uie.com, and you can sign up and get a license for your group, which we'll be clear about our license. You can share it with all the people in your organization. So you can go do that. And even if you saw the live one and you want to go back and have the archive for your folks, you can get that. So thank you very much, Kate. This has been a lot of fun.
Thanks, Jared.
We hope you've enjoyed this Spoolcast. You can comment on this and other episodes, as well as find more UIE podcasts at uie.com/audio. Are you overwhelmed by the data you've gathered from performing a field study or usability test? This coming June 28th, Jared will present our next virtual seminar, Making Sense of Usability Test and Field Study Data. For a mere $129, you can gather your whole team in the comfort of your own office for a live 90-minute lesson on what's next after testing. Sign up at uie.com/events. If you'd like to add the Field Study Handbook we mentioned at the top of the show to your library, you can use promo code PODCASTKATE to purchase it for only $63. That's a $15 savings. That's all one word, PODCASTKATE. Head over to uie.com/reports for more information and to pick up your copy today. That's all for this week. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.